This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about San Luis Obispo County's proposed new campaign finance law.
If anything, Mr. Pashong should have at least had the courage to name it the John Pashong Investment Act, because it really is sort of absurd to think that someone whose business it is to consult on political campaigns would be coming up with this kind of a piece of legislation.
And a Central Coast county finds itself in the most restricted COVID-19 tier.
And then there's Purple, with no indoor dining and movie theaters and places of worship operating outdoors only. That's where Monterey County is.
Those stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 16th. I'm Carol Tangeman. Many in San Luis Obispo County are more than ready to forget about elections for now and focus on other matters. But there's a sizable public opposition to an election-related matter now before the County Board of Supervisors. KCBX's Greta Mart reports.
District 1 Supervisor John Pashong is spearheading a move to allow people to donate up to $25,000 to candidates for county offices like sheriff, district attorney, and supervisor.
$25,000? This is for local races? Wow. I mean, that's an incredibly high amount. Well, I mean, where did they come up with that?
That's election finance expert David Gould. He's the president of the California Political Treasurers Association. And he's one of the authors of California's Political Reform Act of 1974.
Money in politics is going to continue to be a tough issue for our nation and for local communities. And I fear the direction that SLO County may be going with this proposal is going to make money more of a factor, not less of a factor.
That's termed out State Senator Bill Mauning, talking about the proposed new ordinance. There is currently no limit to the amount people and groups can donate to candidates for county offices. The state legislature wanted to change that and passed a new law that kicks in on January 1st. It sets a limit to campaign contributions at just under $5,000. But individual cities and counties across California can pass local campaign laws, and they can set whatever limit they want. If they don't set their own rules, the state law is now the default. And the Fair Political Practices Commission tracks and enforces campaign limits. The local ordinance, poised to be finalized this week, sets a limit of $25,000, five times that of statewide limits.
I don't like it. I think that's way too high. I think the role of money in politics has resulted in fewer people participating as voters because they see money talking in their vote being worth less and less.
Over 100 local residents who wrote emails and made phone calls to the supervisors agree with Mauning and oppose the cap amount.
I think even in this hyper-polarized climate we're living in, one thing we can agree on is that the less big money in politics, the better for little folks in our community.
The average citizen cannot marshal a lot of money to contribute, and the limits should reflect what the average person can provide, not huge organizations.
I need to know what the purpose of this is, because there's no explanation that makes any sense. I do not want five times more glossy mailers in my mailbox that go directly to my recycle bin. I do not want five times more signage on the roads and in front of houses. I do not look forward to five times more radio advertising, TV advertising, and noise. It does not propel democracy to let the person with the most money put out the most advertising.
That was SLO County residents Virginia Roof, Mike Brown, and Lindy Owen. They want the county limit to match the state's or even be lower. So does the League of Women Voters, says local chapter co-president Cindy Marie Absey.
The League's problem with this is for decades we've supported campaign finance practices that seek to combat undue influence and to allow more candidates to compete more equitably for office, and thereby promoting citizen participation in politics.
Absey says with public confidence in government institutions at an all-time low,
we have to work harder than ever to restore the public's trust. And that really falls to our public officials to do that. So for us to see a cap of $25,000 in San Luis Obispo just seems to counter the efforts of the state and even some of the language of the ordinance itself.
But Supervisors Pashong, Arnold, and Compton have now voted twice in favor of setting a $25,000 campaign contribution limit, and they are poised to set the new cap into law. One of Pashong's stated reasons for the high limit is that it doesn't apply to campaign contributors who are independent of the candidate, like political action committees. And if PACs can accept unlimited contributions, then challenging candidates...
to be able to defend themselves, they need to be able to raise money.
Supervisor Debbie Arnold echoed Pashong's rationale.
None of this prohibits individual expenditures. In other words, if you're staying away from the candidate, you can send out a lot of messages, a lot of TV commercials, et cetera. You could have all that going on, and the candidate without the ability to raise enough money to get close to being able to communicate to the voters could be disadvantaged.
And that a low contribution cap would bar people new to political office.
With stricter limits, I believe it would inhibit new candidates that tried to step up the opportunity to get their message out, get their name out, have people know who they are, what they're trying to say, what they're trying to do for their jurisdiction.
That's just bull. That doesn't make any sense. A federal limit on contributions is $2,800 to give the president of the United States.
That's David Gould again. The proposed $25,000 cap, says Cindy Marie Absey, is
significantly larger than other counties that have also adopted their own caps. For instance, Sonoma County, with a population of almost twice San Luis Obispo's population, has a cap of $2,500.
Supervisor Bruce Gibson also doesn't buy Pashong's and Arnold's reasoning, and he casts the lone no vote.
I believe it is poor policy. The state contribution limits are more than adequate, and I believe it would improve our political process to limit the corrosive effects of even more money.
Even Supervisor Lynn Compton questioned the high amount.
I have to say I'm a little uncomfortable with the $25,000. I'm a little uncomfortable with that.
Nevertheless, Compton voted in favor of the $25,000 cap and other stipulations that give wide latitude to big fundraising in the county. Another objection to the high cap plan concerns John Pashong's campaign consultancy company. A, quote, full-service strategic political consulting and public affairs firm, of which he is a partner, Meridian Pacific manages political campaigns across California. For example, a coalition of oil and gas companies paid his firm almost $750,000 to run the No on G campaign, successfully defeating the anti-fracking county ballot measure in 2018. But Pashong says there's no conflict.
I got a letter from Mr. McEwen in Morro Bay this morning that asked me to recuse myself. I have, and my firm has not done any political races in San Luis Obispo County for elected county offices for the last 4 years since I've been elected, and I will not be doing any while I serve as supervisor in San Luis Obispo County.
However, when he is no longer with the county, then his firm may well benefit from a $25,000 cap,
says Absey. Michael Lattner is a political science professor at Cal Poly and senior fellow at the Union for Concerned Scientists.
As someone who studies electoral rules for a living, I really don't think you could come up with a worse piece of legislation in terms of protecting the integrity of these offices.
Lattner says there definitely is a conflict of interest in the proposed ordinance.
This is John Pashong's proposal. It points to the hypocrisy, I think. I mean, if anything, Mr. Pashong should have at least had the courage to name it the John Pashong Investment Act, because it really is sort of absurd to think that someone whose business it is to consult on political campaigns would be coming up with this kind of a piece of legislation.
The statewide campaign contribution law, which goes into effect on January 1st, was passed over a year ago. In order to bypass that, individual municipalities have to have their own law in effect by then. Here's Supervisor Compton again.
I don't like defaulting to the state on things, so I like the fact that we're going to do our own ordinance, it sounds like. And if we decide it's not working, then we can tweak it in the future as long as we have something in place.
But those opposed say there's no need to pass these new rules, and it sets a dangerous precedent for local democracy, says Lattner.
If you open up this system and you make Slo County the only county where you can buy off a campaign and purchase yourself influence in a county supervisor's campaign or a DA's campaign or the sheriff's campaign, you're really having the effect of just really stifling free speech.
During an introduction of the new ordinance Tuesday, Pashong says there will be another public hearing at the November 17th board meeting. The public can email comments to the County Board of Supervisors or staff in the meantime, something that ABSE of the League of Women Voters urges.
People can still make their voices heard, and that's democracy at work. If you're concerned about campaign finance limits and caps and the influence of big money in our local campaigns, this is something our citizens need to care about and get involved in now, because the decision will be made within the month of November.
With KCBX News, I'm Greta Marr, reporting in San Luis Obispo County.
Monterey County is stuck in the state's most restrictive COVID-19 category, the purple tier, even as counties surrounding it have been able to reopen. KAZU's Michelle Loxton has more.
Before we begin, I want to warn you, this story is complicated. There are tiers, metrics, and rules, but stick with me. So let's start. Local COVID-19 restrictions are determined by the state's COVID-19 monitoring system called a Blueprint for a Safer Economy. This updated system was introduced by California Governor Gavin Newsom in late August.
We wanted to make adjustments based upon the input we received from county health officers, input we received from experts, our own experience here in the state of California.
It consists of four tiers. Let's run through them. Yellow is the least restrictive tier. Only a few counties in California are in that category. They are mostly located near the border with Nevada. The next tier is orange. Our neighbor to the north, Santa Clara County, is in that tier. Smaller amusement parks can open, restaurants can serve indoors, and places of worship can host more people inside. The next tier is red. Our neighbors, Santa Cruz and San Benito counties, are in that one. Their restrictions are similar to orange, but with less capacity. And then there's purple, the most restrictive. With no indoor dining and movie theaters and places of worship operating outdoors only. That's where Monterey County is. So how are these tiers decided? There are three metrics the state looks at to determine which tier a county will be in. Back when he introduced the system, Newsom explained why these metrics matter.
The metrics that we assert are the most significant in terms of giving us a leading indicator of how things are taking shape in a particular part of the state.
The metrics are case rate per 100,000 people, positivity rate, which is how many people have tested positive out of all that have been tested, and the equity rate, which studies the positivity rate in the most disadvantaged communities. Collectively, all of these three metrics need to make it into a certain colored tier together before a county can progress. But there is one workaround that Monterey County has been trying to take advantage of. The state says if two out of the three metrics make it into the orange tier, the entire county can move into the red tier. And according to recent calculations by the county, two of their metrics have done just that. The problem? The state is not using the same laboratory data as Monterey County. Dr. Edward Moreno, the county's health officer, spoke at a recent Board of Supervisors meeting about what they plan to do about this.
We submitted an adjudication request to the California Department of Public Health. So California Department of Public Health will consider requests for adjudication if there is a data discrepancy, which we believe there is, in the metrics, and that the discrepancy is significant enough to affect the tier status, which we believe it does.
Unfortunately, the state didn't agree and declined Monterey County's adjudication request earlier this week. So that means Monterey County stays in the most restrictive purple tier for now. Dr. Moreno said the decision was disappointing, but he's always had the same message about the coronavirus.
Regardless of the state's decision, we as a community still need to follow these measures to reduce the spread of COVID-19.
Measures like physical distancing, wearing face coverings, washing hands frequently, and staying home if you are sick, to name a few. Keeping up with these practices is the only way that Monterey County moves out of the purple tier and into a less restrictive one. And as cases increase across the nation and locally, that becomes harder and harder. Michelle Loxton, KEZU News.
San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties remain in the red tier for now. Local health officials will be looking at the latest numbers to be released tomorrow. In honor of the recent Veterans Day, correspondent Tom Wilmer reports from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County. First Sergeant Clinton Unger shares insights and admiration for the United States Army Reserve's active duty soldiers and veterans. And Commander Charles Bell explains the status of COVID-19 preventative measures at the base.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett. Come along and join us as we visit with First Sergeant Unger. As you know, the reason I wanted to visit with you has to do with Veterans Day and what it means to you.
The original reason for Veterans Day was Armistice, and so it's the stop of fighting, yes.
So you grew up with the military model close to your heart and your family, literally.
Yes, sir.
Where did you grow up and when and why did you join?
I grew up in Texas. I'd always wanted to join, always wanted to serve my country. That's the whole reason why I get up. That's why I continue to serve, is just giving back to the community, giving back to the country, giving back to those people that have lived and served before us.
A little bit more about you. You're a first sergeant.
Yes, sir.
So talk to us about your role and your duties.
My duties as a first sergeant are that of a generalist, to support my organization as a whole, to support the people, to make sure they have everything that they need, from food to money to anything that can support them or their families.
So you're like mayor in a sense.
I wouldn't go that glamorous. I'm more like the janitorial custodian that makes sure and cleans up all the issues that other people have kind of left for us.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been stationed at Fort Hunter Liggett?
I arrived here this summer, so I've only been here just a few months.
And you'll be here a couple of years?
Yes, sir. I'll be here two to three.
Yeah. And looking forward?
I'm still young enough and have kids that are young enough that, you know, we're interested in traveling. We've been from the East Coast to the Central to now on the West Coast. So I'd be willing to go to other countries. I'd be willing to serve wherever that I'm sent. So I've got lots of opportunities in my career field.
Final thoughts about veterans and what that means to you?
Veterans, it's a great appreciation that I have to be part of this community, that I have the opportunity to serve, you know, like I said, my country, the people that are in the country. And even though there's all kinds of craziness right now with COVID and, you know, elections, all of those different pieces, but we're all in the same country. We all still live here. We all pull together. And me being a veteran is able for me to serve back to my community and those people that are here, whether we have agreements or we don't. It's still all of us together.
Would you agree that the mission of the Army and the military is beyond and above politics? There's a greater good element.
Correct. Yes, I agree. That's the attitude of serving. Everybody has something that they look forward to, whether it's faith in humanity, faith in the other person that they know and they care about, or faith in a higher power. So, yes, I agree. All of those are greater than somebody who's individually elected or appointed or any of those things. We have that common bond.
First Sergeant Unger, thank you so much for sharing. It was great to meet you.
Thank you for your time, Tom. I appreciate you.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett, where we've been speaking with First Sergeant Unger.
KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer will now check in with Commander Bell.
An update on the world of COVID as it relates to the United States military.
Thanks, Tom. Again, nice seeing you, and thanks for coming out. Just to talk a little bit about COVID and talk a little bit about what we're doing here at Fort Hunter Liggett. We've been really successful. You know, we've learned how to operate in a COVID environment. We've learned how to continue our mission in this environment.
I know that mask wearing is super stringent. He wouldn't even look at my DOD pass until I put my mask on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly how we've been successful, is maintaining our health protection condition. So we've lowered our health protection condition to Bravo, but we've remained with the same protocols as we did when we were in health protection condition Charlie. And what that really means is that, just like we are now, we're like 6 or 7 feet apart. So we're maintaining social distance. We're wearing our masks. We're using our hand sanitizer. Our soldiers that are training here have to do the same thing. And then even before our soldiers arrive, to training, we're contacting them 14 days prior. What we're doing is we're saying, hey, you're coming to Fort Hunter Liggett to train. How are you feeling? And we're going through the list of questions. You know, do you have a fever? Have you been around anybody with COVID? You know, the whole list of pre-screening questions. And then we're going back to them 5 days out saying, hey, I know we talked to you 14 days ago, but now we're 5 days out. I'm going to ask you this again. And then when they arrive, especially if they're flying in, our cadre here at the TTC meets them at the airport and does an in-person check, checks the temperature, pre-screening. And then when they get through our gate, we do it one more time. And so if there's any indication at any time in that process that somebody has been exposed or they're showing signs or symptoms, we segregate them from everybody else. Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody's been that safe. So we segregate those folks. We have them tested. And then they're quarantined in such a time that their test results come back and they're either negative or positive. If they're positive, then of course they stay in quarantine. We then call it isolation, but it's the same thing. But I can tell you, we've trained like 11, we're probably up to 12,000 soldiers across our garrison. I'd say probably upwards of 12,000 at this point. And we've had 8-9 COVID cases from soldiers that are training here. A relatively small number when you consider the large number of soldiers that have trained here since the start of COVID. And the success that we had operating in the COVID environment, while our soldiers are here, we have a thing called a bubble, but really what it amounts to is a cohort. We separate them in cohorts so that if there is a issue that it's isolated to that cohort, you know, even though those folks are in a cohort, they still have to wear masks, socially distance, use hand sanitizer. So Tom, I'll tell you that for the large number of soldiers that we've trained on our installation, we've had a relatively small number of COVID cases.
A literal handful.
A small number, single digits. So,
okay. Colonel Charles Bell, thank you for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Again, Tom, always nice to see you. Thanks for coming out, and look forward to seeing you again.
Well, I look forward to. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fort Hunter, Liggett, and Monterey County, where we've been visiting with Base Commander Colonel Charles Bell.
You'll find a longer version of this story on our website, kcbx.org. Up next, the nonprofit story. KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes helps us understand how Hospice of San Luis Obispo County operates and what sets it apart.
Welcome to the nonprofit story. Today I have Shannon McQuatt. She is the executive director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. For over 42 years, the Hospice of San Luis Obispo County has been serving our community. So we're so happy to welcome Shannon here and have her tell us more about their services. Welcome to the nonprofit story, Shannon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I know you do a wonderful service in our communities. The hospice has been around for over 42 years. Give us a little bit of background. And in particular, would you let us know what it means that you are a volunteer hospice in lieu of being a medically certified hospice?
Yeah, thank you. So as you said, we started in this community in 1977, and our model, our non-medical volunteer-based hospice, is actually the original hospice model that came to life in the United States in the late 70s. And being a non-medical volunteer hospice, we're really navigating and supporting people in the social, emotional realm of end of life and bereavement. And so all of our frontline, our services are provided by volunteers, highly trained volunteers. We have a small but mighty staff, paid staff, who also provide support and services. But we, being non-medical, we're not dealing with pain management or that we don't have nurses or doctors on board. We are offering in-home respite and companionship. We are supporting people. We can support people at time of diagnosis. So with a medically certified hospice, there's the requirement that a doctor refers them and has said that they have 6 months or less to live. The patient gives up all curative treatment, and moves to medical hospice. And that is a service that is paid for through insurance and Medicare. With a non-medical hospice, we can start serving people at time of diagnosis. We don't have the limitations of the Medicare benefit. We do not charge for services. So as a volunteer hospice, we cannot and do not charge for services. So we remain accessible, and we're not in competition with the medical hospices. We can work together. So they can have us, they can start with us, and we can support them, and then we can help navigate them when appropriate and at time to move to a medical hospice, and then we can stay and collaborate with the medical hospice to continue that full spectrum of support. So our services include in-home respite and companionship. We have end-of-life doulas who are highly trained volunteers that really walk people through the end of life with legacy work, creating a death plan, and sitting vigil, doing bedside vigiling in the last 48 to 72 hours of life. We have a pet peace of mind program where we put volunteers on the animal with the goal of keeping the animal with the human through the human's end of life. So for example, if it's a dog, a volunteer will go and walk the dog, get the dog to the groomer or the vet if needed, help with waste management, kind of just picking up the extra care and support of that animal so they can stay with their human. And then if the human doesn't have a plan for that animal after they're gone, we'll work with them to develop a plan and talk about what they really want for their animal. And we will foster that animal and work to find it an adoptive home after the human has passed.
So does this service come by the request of a family, or can people individually request your services?
Both. We get a lot of self-referrals. We get a lot of referrals from family and friends. We get referrals from home health agencies, from medical hospices, from hospitals, from the Alzheimer's Association, Hearst Cancer Resource Center, from all areas of the community, people find us.
Are you able to continue your services even with the COVID-19 situation?
We have been to, unfortunately, a more limited capacity, but in our grief counseling bereavement area, we were able to pivot rather quickly to offer phone and virtual support. So our individual grief counseling has continued, and our support groups are all happening on the Zoom platform. As far as our volunteers going into people's homes, we did, of course, have to step back at the shelter in place orders. But our volunteers continue to keep in touch with their clients through phone calls, check-ins, making sure the caregivers were holding up, doing grocery deliveries, any kind of tracking down masks and personal protective equipment for their clients. And then as restrictions lifted, some of our volunteers started meeting outdoors, physically distanced to connect. So all of our volunteers have gone through training, safety training, to better prepare them to support people through the pandemic.
That's wonderful. How often does the volunteer connect with the person?
So we ask our volunteers to commit to 4 hours a week. And that, how that looks is really works out between the volunteer and the client's family, whether that's 4 hours all at once or maybe two-hour sessions. Right now, during COVID, that's looking like phone check-ins every couple days just to make sure everyone is still safe and healthy and making sure they aren't needing any supplies or added support.
And when you talk about respite services, do any of the volunteers ever go in the home, like to cook food or to clean?
Yeah. So, I mean, traditionally, that is our model. Our volunteers can do some light housekeeping and they can do some meal prep, but it's really about creating that connection with the client, supporting them in whatever way, you know, is most needed at that time. And sometimes that is maybe doing the dishes, or sometimes it's reading a book, and sometimes it's going for a walk. But it's really about creating that connection and allowing the caregiver to have some space to take care of themselves, whether to run errands or do some self-care or to just, you know, mentally be able to step back for a couple of hours and regroup.
I know with the medically certified hospice, and I think you mentioned it, it's usually going to be about 6 months is the usual time they think you'll be there. Is that requirement on your volunteer hospice also?
It is not. Because we're not medically certified, we don't have that that limitation. And so many, I think our average length of stay for a client on our service is about 18 months. And many of our clients have some sort of cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's, dementia diagnosis. That disease is a much longer trajectory, and there's not as much support out there, especially for the caregivers. So that is an area that we're really seeing a big increase in offering support to that population.
You're right. I mean, there's just not that much care for those types of long-term illnesses. So how does a person become a volunteer, and how do they learn about the needs of the people that they're going to serve?
It's about a 30-hour training, of course, broken up. We have a remarkable training manual. So we have people read the material, and then they come each week, and we have an experiential training. What we talk about is the manual helps us understand our community needs and the different diagnoses that we're navigating and different end-of-life issues that they might come into contact with. But the training itself is really about themselves, to explore their relationship with death and dying, to explore grief so that they can really have a great understanding about where they are, so that when they go to support somebody who's experiencing this firsthand, they can leave their own stuff outside and come in and be fully present and hold space for whatever their client is needing at that time.
So about how many people do you serve on an annual basis?
You know, in the different categories of services that we're offering, for example, we offered over 3,000 hours of individual family grief counseling sessions last year. Mm-hmm. We offered over 400 facilitated support groups. We provided over 1,000 hours of end-of-life doula support and over 3,000 hours of in-home respite care.
Would that be different volunteers, or sometimes volunteers cross and do different things?
Sometimes volunteers are doing multiple services. You know, for example, an in-home volunteer might also be a pet peace of mind volunteer, and an end-of-life doula might also be a pet peace of mind volunteer. And we offered about 431 hours of pet support last year.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of good training. And I guess it gives your patient a peace of mind because they know that their pet is being cared for.
Absolutely. And that's the whole goal of the program. A lot of folks, you know, they refuse to leave their home, either go to a hospital or a care facility, because they don't want to leave their animal and they don't have a plan for that animal. It's incredibly stressful. This is a member of their family. And so we want to get in there and just reassure them that the animal will be cared for, and our goal is to keep them together as long as possible.
This is KCBX and Issues and Ideas. You're listening to a conversation between KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes and Shannon McQuad of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County.
So we're supporting people to fill out their advanced healthcare directives, which is a critical document for anyone 18 or over to have that in place. It's a kind of a fluid document that can be updated annually or as life changes occur. But what it is determining who your medical advocate would be if you were unable to make medical decisions for yourself, if you were incapacitated in some way. And then it's really outlining what your wishes would be health-wise in certain circumstances. And of course, those decisions will look different for an 18-year-old than they might look for an 80-year-old or somebody who, you know, with end-stage cancer diagnosis. So we can help navigate that. process and just more education about the different tools and end-of-life decisions that are to be considered.
Yeah, I noticed that you have the advanced healthcare directive on your website. Is that something that can be downloaded and filled in, or do you need to go to their home, or how does that actually work? And is there a fee for it?
You know what? There's no fee. We do not charge for any of our services here at Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. There are a plethora of options for different advanced healthcare documents online that you can download and fill out. We've had some great success during the pandemic of actually setting up Zoom calls with people and having them have a printed document, and we bring the document up on the screen and we can walk them through it and have that conversation. We could also document all of their decisions on a form on our end, print it and mail it to them for them to have witnessed. You can either have it witnessed by two people or have it notarized to make it a complete package.
Such a great help. You talk about working with people for end-of-life decisions. Do you find it difficult to talk to people about these topics? Do people not want to speak about the process that is inevitable for all of us?
It can be a challenge. It is certainly something that people are hesitant to discuss. However, when somebody's been given a life-limiting diagnosis or has a terminal diagnosis, it's still difficult, but it becomes more of a reality. We have found that when people are willing, regardless of what their health status is, when people are willing to engage in these conversations, it actually helps lighten the fear, and it helps them feel more prepared and empowered to make these decisions and face what we're all, as you said, inevitably going to face.
I would think you would include the whole family in on those conversations if needed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just really providing that education. And sometimes it's helping if one person's really wanting to have that conversation and maybe a family member is really hesitant to have that conversation, just helping the whole unit come together to have an open, honest, respectful conversation about someone's wishes.
I noticed on your website that you had some programs that needed to be suspended because of the COVID-19, such as your community response and, as you'd mentioned, your in-home service. Will you be getting those going again in the future, or will things change?
We're slowly getting those going. We have done a couple of community responses that have been able to take place outdoors and with physical distancing. So we have been able to do that. We've been able to do a little bit of that work over Zoom as well, to create that physically safe space and emotional safe space for people to process a loss. Our in-home volunteers, we have a handful of folks that are going back into homes, but that's after they've had training, safety precaution training, and both the volunteer and the client agree to wear masks and maintain physical distance and to be in a space that's well ventilated and appropriate for connection.
Also, on your grief counseling, can anybody also get grief counseling if they're still holding on from grief?
Our services are available to the community free of charge, regardless of when, where, how, or who has died. So if we offer support for pet loss, suicide bereavement, spouse and partner loss, if somebody lost their loved one 10 years ago and they're just now, something's come up and they're just now sort of the grief has reemerged or they haven't processed it, they can absolutely come and receive grief support here, even though it's been 10 years. And regardless of what hospice or how they died, again, many of our clients that we're supporting through counseling are coming to us because they've had a traumatic death, a sudden death or loss, and they're needing support through that.
So you say that you're supported by the community and that there are no charges. Tell us something about that. How would people be able to support you if they would feel so inclined?
We welcome and appreciate donations. They can go to our website. They can become a GEM, which is a Gives Every Month donor, which is really the program that helps sustain us so that we know what our income donation income is each month. We're happy to talk with people about plan giving and bequests and estate planning. We absolutely rely on community support and community grants as well.
And most of that is going to go to be able to keep these services going and to do your wonderful training and get your volunteers, and then offering all of this back to the community for no charge. How broad of a distance do you cover? Do you cover all of San Luis Obispo County?
Yep, we cover the entire county. And right now, you know, because we turned to this virtual platform, especially in the counseling, we're even more accessible now to people who are remote or limited by transportation through the phone and virtual means. And we don't see that going away anytime at all. And as far as volunteer support, our main limitation is whether or not we have volunteers available in that community. So the other way people can give back is by becoming a volunteer, going through our training, and being available to offer support in one's own community within the greater San Luis Obispo County.
How often do you offer the training?
We offer the training quarterly, at least minimally, at least quarterly. So four times. Sometimes we squeeze in a couple extras throughout the year.
Well, Shannon, tell people how they can find your website so they can get more information.
HospiceSLO.org to find Hospice of San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you so much for joining us today on The Nonprofit Story. I've been speaking with Shannon McQuatt, the Executive Director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County.
That was a conversation between KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes and Shannon McQuatt of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. And finally, KCBX contributor and Downtown SLO CEO Bettina Swigger has a conversation with Paso Robles City Manager Tom Frucci about the challenges and opportunities facing these two Central Coast cities.
For Issues and Ideas, this is Bettina Swigger with our monthly segment called Around Downtown. For today's segment, we're going to be speaking with Tom Frucci, who is the city manager for the city of Paso Robles. And in addition to being a host for KCBX, I also serve as the CEO of Downtown San Luis Obispo. So we'll be talking about our respective downtowns and what downtowns have been dealing with during the pandemic and how we expect to recover. Thanks so much for being with me today, Tom.
I'm pleased to do it, Bettina. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I don't have much chance.
You and I met a couple of years ago when we both went on a trip that was organized by the San Luis Obispo Chamber, and we went on a trip to Denver and Boulder with a number of economic development professionals to see how their communities had embraced regionalism. So that was a couple of years ago now, but you had been recently arrived to the Central Coast. So when did you come to the city of Paso Robles?
Let's see, about 5 years ago. So January 2016.
And where did you come from?
City of Pacific Grove was the city I worked in just immediately prior to Paso. I've pretty much been a 101 city manager. This is my fifth city, but all cities were along the 101. And so Suzanne and I, my wife Suzanne and I, have been driving between the Bay Area and Los Angeles and other areas for decades, years and years and years. And we almost always have stopped in Paso Robles. It's just a great place to stop, obviously the midway point. But Jim App was city manager for, I don't know, 20, 25 years. So there was never a chance to actually come here and work here. So when Jim retired, I absolutely had to apply. And fortunately, I was selected.
Can you talk a little bit about what your role is as city manager?
So in California, there are really two major types of municipal governance. One is a strong mayor form. That's usually reserved for the big cities. And then there's what's called the council manager form. And so the council members, who are the elected policymakers and budget adopters, et cetera, they really set the direction for the community. And it's up to the city manager as CEO of the municipal corporation to hire staff, to put together the programs, to recommend policies to the council. And then when the council makes a decision, to implement that decision. So for example, when the council adopts the annual budget or biannual budget, whatever the approach the city uses, it's the city manager's job to take that decision, take that plan that the council's adopted and implemented. And so really it's a kind of a cross between a CEO and a COO position.
And that's sort of the same format that we have for many cities on the Central Coast. San Luis Obispo is the same with Derek Johnson serving in the city manager role. Do you have connections with other city managers for other cities?
Sure. So in fact, one of the things I love about this county is that the seven city managers are very close. During the pandemic, we've been meeting weekly, obviously virtual meetings, but we've been meeting weekly, the seven of us plus Wade Horton and Guy Savage, to talk through all the issues that have arisen as a result of the pandemic, but also address other issues, because one of the nice things about this county is we all recognize, and I think the spirit was there before the trip to Denver and Boulder, but it was certainly reinforced by that trip, that we all do better when we do it collaboratively. That doesn't mean in any way we give up any of our individualism, any of the things that make each of the seven communities unique and special. But we know if we work together, we'll just be that much more successful. And that's obviously our job, is to do what's best for our communities for the long term.
Well, it sounds like you have strong relationships, and those relationships existed before the pandemic. What a position of strength to go into this challenging time, right? I can imagine if you didn't have those relationships and then you had to forge those when the adrenaline is pumping. And
in fact, so six of us have been working together for several years, but Whitney McDonald, the new city manager of Arroyo Grande, I've never met her, never been, as far as I know, anywhere geographically close to her. So the six of us have developed a relationship with her on Zoom calls, on the phone, and it's been seamless. So yes, things are certainly different under the pandemic, but I can't imagine having this county do this well. Not that we can't do better, but I can't imagine this county doing this well if we didn't have such a close bond and work so well together.
Speaking to our respective cities' downtowns, obviously downtown Paso Robles is very important to the city. Downtown San Luis Obispo is very important to the city of San Luis Obispo. Same with all of our cities around the Central Coast. How has downtown changed in Paso Robles over the last 7 months?
It's changed in quite a few ways. Unfortunately, some of them are negative, as one might expect, because there's been so much stress on the downtown. I mean, not that there weren't stressors before, you know, with minimum wage, restaurants were struggling. And we have some great restaurants, but still it has been very difficult for restaurants in downtowns. But then the pandemic just took away all of our chances to do the types of events that are so successful at bringing not only people within our county, but people from outside the county to the downtown to enjoy the downtown. And so just like San Luis Obispo, we've all worked very hard to find ways to help the downtown survive and in some ways thrive through this period of time. I think none of us thought it was going to last this long, but it now appears that, you know, a lot of the things we thought we were doing that would just be temporary may be activities and approaches that continue for quite a few years. And if you believe the public health specialists, pandemics are going to be much more frequent in upcoming years. So. And that's one of the wonders of downtowns. I mean, they essentially recreate themselves every generation or two. They adapt, they're dynamic. There's lots of energy and ideas that just bubble up to help them be what they are. And so I think you and Downtown SLO have just done a fabulous job. And we've worked really hard in Paso to, you know, we inherited these wonderful downtowns.
Totally.
They were created both through the forethought and organically by people that came before us. And it's our, you know, opportunity and responsibility, as the ancient Athenians said, to leave the city greater and better than it was when it was entrusted to us. And that's why we do what we do.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. This is Around Downtown with Bettina Swigger of San Luis Obispo and Tom Frucci of Paso Robles.
It sounds like
We both believe in the value of the public square. And literally in Paso Robles, you have the park that's the center focal point of the downtown. Now, I moved to the Central Coast about 10 years ago, and I've seen that park sort of become enlivened and activated in new ways. What's happened in the park over the last couple of months and over the summer?
So you're absolutely right. The park is the soul, the heart and soul of the downtown and of the city, really. And just a story, a pre-pandemic story. About 4 years ago, we were fortunate enough to get a state parks grant to upgrade the children's playground right there at the southwest corner of the park. And the Rec Foundation also was a great contributor to that and turned out beautifully. And one of the things I think nobody knows is exactly what is the magic about the types of wings and other structures for the kids to play on. And it's right across the street from City Hall and from Council Chamber. And so the very first council meeting we had after we opened the new park, and it's dark and it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. And we kept hearing these kids playing in the park. I mean, even after dark, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't not be there. It was just, and it's been like that. There are buses that come from surrounding communities to bring people, the kids to play in that park. And so it's great for kids. It's great for events. We hold, not this summer, but a lot of summers, the concert series in the park. But then something special happened during the pandemic, and it's one of those organic ideas that just grow and you have no idea how successful it ends up being. But some of our key stakeholders like Gina Fitzpatrick at the Chamber and Stacy Jacob at Travel Paso and Joel Peterson at Wine Country Alliance and Gina at Main Street, they're all trying to find a way to keep attracting people to the downtown without people putting people at risk. So they came up with this idea. They knew that restaurants were barely surviving, but surviving based on takeout. They came up with this idea of converting a portion of the park that isn't used very often to socially responsible, basically group picnic tables. And so all the tables are spaced appropriately in the area surrounded by a nice fence to keep it isolated. And there were two really nice young people who greeted you as you came in. And Paul Sloan at the Chamber at the time figured out a way to do reservations through Yelp. So it very quickly became this opportunity for people from home or from work to order their dinners, pick them up, and then have a wonderful time just sitting in the park and with their family or their significant other or a friend or two enjoying dining. And it's still not closed. I mean, it's still going on. And in fact, we just had kind of a celebration, a socially distant celebration. We just had a celebration of how successful it was. And it didn't take anything away from the parklets and, you know, sidewalk and parking lane dining that a lot of restaurants established for themselves. It just gave one additional opportunity for people to eat out and enjoy, you know, the fabulous park, the fabulous weather, at least most of the time. Just another great use of the park.
It sounds too like that's a great example of what a public-private partnership can accomplish outside of maybe what a municipal government can accomplish. You've brought in partners. You mentioned the strategic nonprofit partners who came in on that program, even a technology platform like Yelp. I think in the 21st century, we really need to approach public space management through this lens of identifying strategic partners and calling on their strengths to find ways to activate our public spaces in ways that we might not have thought of by ourselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's always the question, what should be the role of the city? How much do we just facilitate and support? How much do we nudge? How much do we insert ourselves? You know, and that's cities and downtowns have this very long-standing, not love-hate relationship, but certainly...
Let's call it a dance.
It's a dance, a creative, yeah, creative tension and how to help each other be successful.
Yeah, we have a similar program in San Luis Obispo. It's not quite the same flavor of the park dining that you have, but we have a Dine Out Downtown program in Mission Plaza where we just have tables and chairs and umbrellas set up and there's no reservation required. But it's been really interesting to see how just simply putting tables and chairs in a public space creates a sense of community that otherwise didn't exist.
Absolutely, because otherwise we'd be eating at home, maybe in our backyard, but probably in the kitchen or dining room. And it's a whole different experience when it's outside, when it's in a park or other communal area, when you see people around you staying safe, but still, I mean, meals are intended to be enjoyed, not sitting watching TV or rushing through on our phone while we're on our phones or whatever else. And so I think, and I'm sure it's true in San Luis, I think a lot of people in Paso rediscovered the joy of just eating a wonderfully casual, enjoyable meal outdoors.
How do you see the downtown recovering from the initial shutdown? I'm part of a group called the International Downtown Association, and I'm frequently on calls with CEOs of downtown associations from large urban areas. And they're seeing major problems because they have skyscrapers full of offices that people are not returning to. And I think our downtowns are uniquely positioned where we don't necessarily have that challenge, although we certainly have challenges of our own.
So we still obviously have vacancies that we wouldn't have otherwise had. We still have businesses that are struggling. But I think it's that Chinese term for crisis that the pictographs are a combination of challenge and opportunity. I think that's what this is really demonstrating. And I think we don't know yet how our downtown's going to fully recover. I think that's still being developed, but it has certainly brought people together. It's certainly energized people to give back to the downtown. We knew even before the pandemic that our downtown had to evolve. It's just, we've been very fortunate in that the way the downtown evolved since the 80s and 90s, when there were many, many vacancies, has been fairly organic and a lot of local businesses. We don't have any chains in the downtown, so we don't have McDonald's or, you know, a chain bookstore or anything. It's all run, created and run and owned by local people. But it was a downtown that was searching for a way to serve both the locals and the visitors and to serve different demographics. You know, it's a downtown that's very comfortable serving, you know, older people with backgrounds similar to what most people in Paso's background is. But how do we serve visitors from other countries? How do we serve visitors from different demographics? How do we serve the young who want something much different when they go out? They want more of an experience. Well, I'm telling you, you know them better than I. They want more of an experience. They want something that will excite their senses in several different ways. And so we've been trying to think through that. And I've been to IDA conferences that really focused on that. And that's something we're still working to figure out. And once again, it's what's the city's role going to be versus what is the role of the private sector and the downtown business association.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Tom.
Of course, Bettina. Anytime I have a chance to talk to you, I enjoy it.
Likewise. Well, let's make it a more frequent occurrence. This is Bettina Swigger for Issues and Ideas. I've been speaking with Tom Frucci, the city manager for the city of Paso Robles.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.